Hello and welcome to this conference all about anxiety. My name is Jaya Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am delighted to be welcoming Melissa Douglas. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, Jaya. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So Melissa is a therapist, a social worker, a professor, and a mental health consultant who manages a virtual practice. So you're very well placed to be talking to us about anxiety. And I'm curious, in your sort of professional context, where you find that anxiety is most comes up most of the time and what anxiety means to you, because of course, it's a really broad topic.
Absolutely. It is a really large topic. In my practice, I work with a lot of students. So high school, post-secondary, new professionals, and we really focus on working with people who are going through life transitions. So that's where I notice anxiety comes up a lot. It's around the expectations of maybe what they feel is required of them, but then also that angst, that kind of natural angst that comes up when we are navigating something different, right? So we're familiar and we already know what we've kind of been experiencing, what we've been doing. But when we're making that next decision about a new school, a new program, a new job, maybe getting married, maybe being a parent for the first time, maybe we're getting divorced, just all those different things that come up, that's something that we haven't experienced before. And that can cause a lot of anxiety. I really like to normalize anxiety sometimes too, and the aspect of it's not just when things are hard or we're in a difficult space or have experienced some kind of trauma. Anxiety comes up when we're navigating good things too. Like there are great things that come with a wedding or promotion or, you know, exiting a bad relationship that also has some anxiety with it as well. But I would absolutely say in the last several years, definitely social media, just all of the pressures that come from that external world, as well as the comparison of what it looks like I'm supposed to be doing, thinking, feeling. And if I'm not in that particular space, then I'm shaming myself for that. And that can spear anxiety in a whole different way as well. So very large answer, I know, but definitely in transitions, definitely exacerbated by external factors. And it comes in both good and bad times too.
And I really like, I love what you're saying around naming some of the different types of transitions that one can have in life. You know, you talked about like transitioning from school in out of school or changing programs or getting married or becoming a parent, you know, or changing jobs. And I love what you were saying about how anxiety can come up both in the sort of like, if we lose a job, for example, then that's a big transition. And that's, you know, that's scary and can, of course, be anxiety inducing. But it can also come up in like positive transitions or good events, you know, like you talked about weddings or promotions. So I think that's so important to acknowledge that it's not always, as you say, it's not always like a traumatic event that's anxiety provoking. And it doesn't just come up in people who have, like, of course, it's connected to trauma, and people who have suffered trauma will probably have more heightened anxiety, but it's not just those people. It's everyone is impacted by anxiety. And that's why it's such a broad topic. And that's why it's so important to have these conversations.
Yeah. To be anxious is part of the human experience. Like, absolutely, it's one of our just natural primitive emotions that we have as people, because it's fear-based, right? Mm-hmm. And what human do we know that doesn't fear something? Right. So just, I think, normalizing that and having the conversation that says like, hey, you know, to some degree, what you're experiencing is actually to be expected. And when we think about the intensity, the duration, or the frequency of the symptoms that we're experiencing with anxiety, then we can talk about it moving into the space of mental illness. But to be anxious is to be normal or to be human.
And again, what you're talking about, fear is such a normal emotion. And comparison, when you were talking about social media and how anxiety often shows up as like what it we think we're supposed to be or what it looks like we're supposed to be. And so I think that, as you say, anxiety is a normal part of the human experience, but in today's era, it's definitely heightened across in so many different ways, right? Because there's social media that which heightens it. We're still living through a global pandemic. Even I think it's, I don't know, in some countries it's officially no longer a pandemic, in others it's still a pandemic, but either way, we're all like living through that, you know. And then there's like things like the racial tensions across the globe have always existed, but are suddenly being talked about a lot more, and people experience anxiety on all, you know, across the spectrum about these kind of things. And then this climate crisis, and then so there's so much going on in the world, and then people have all their personal stuff happening. Then of course there's things like relationships, you know, which of course bring up stuff. So I'm not naming all these things to cause anxiety in our listeners. That's absolutely not what I want to do. I'm just reiterating what you're saying about anxiety is a normal part of human experience. And in today's age, it's totally, I think, normal that it's even more heightened.
Absolutely. Yes.
And so what are some ways that you work with clients then who are coming in suffering from anxiety? And maybe because we established that's quite broad, let's focus especially on anxiety around transitions. What are some ways that you support clients going through transitions, whether positive or negative?
Yes. So I think in this space, the experience of having anxiety really manifests in a symptom of ruminating, right? So our brains are going 90 miles a minute. And I like to sometimes just, you know, bring a little fun to the conversation. It's sometimes our brain can do the what if game to no end. And it's a rabbit hole. Well, what if this? And what about that? And what if this? And it can just go on and on and on. And when I tell clients that, they're like, oh my gosh, like, how did you know? So I think the ruminating thoughts that come because we're moving into a space that we're not familiar with, we have these ideas, we have these thoughts and considerations of what we think this next phase is going to look like and what the expectations are, but we haven't lived it yet. So there's just all this stuff that's trapped inside of us that's causing us to be overloaded with these thoughts that are just free floating within our minds. And so I like to do a little bit of education first when it comes to anxiety for people to understand, like, why is this happening, right? Why are all these thoughts going? Why can't I seem to slow them down? Why does it seem like my brain is always so noisy? And so I like to explain like what that process looks like sometimes in our brains for anxiety. And when we have these neurons that develop from our amygdala, so very back part of our brains, and these neurons are being developed. And when we have these fear-based emotions, sometimes there's an overdevelopment of those neurons that are happening. But those neurons have to travel all the way to the front of our brains up here in our prefrontal cortex to actually be rationalized. So this is where all of our executive functioning skills are, where we're able to problem solve, critically think, do the rationalization, all those things. And I like to educate my clients on understanding that sometimes when there's an overproduction of those anxiety-based or anxiety-rooted neurons that are being developed, they don't always make it up here. Like, this doesn't look like a long way to travel before a little microscopic neuron. That's like going to the moon, right? And so just having that education that allows them to understand what's actually happening on a neurological level. Mm-hmm. And it helps them to understand and apply some of the interventions and the coping skills that we then suggest. So things like learning how to ground ourselves, to do deep breathing, to practice mindfulness, to sometimes just brain dump with journaling. Like, when we have so many thoughts that are going on and where we have so many things that we are like, well, what if this and what if that? Sometimes journaling and saying, okay, everything that's in my brain right now, I'm just going to put it on this paper. If I can solve it, figure out a solution to it, answer the question, great. If I can't, I'm just going to walk away from it for a moment and allow myself to center. Like, that can be helpful when we just have a lot of things that are going on. So before we get to the interventions and the coping tools and really applying some things to help decrease some of those symptoms that are really displaying themselves, that education first, because clients then get why deep breathing is so helpful. If I have all of these free floating neurons that are going on or traveling in my brain, and they're not in the space to be properly processed, when we're doing that deep breathing and we're grounding ourselves and we're decreasing our heart rate, it's allowing all of that movement to also slow down. And so I think it helps clients to be a lot more invested and understand why what we recommend is actually helpful. And it makes that connection between the psychological and mental space and the biology just of our bodies and how those things work. And I think it also helps to decrease some of the shame that's sometimes associated with people who have a much more increased intensity of symptoms, because there's then this added question of, well, what's wrong with me? You know, why can't I slow this down? Why can't I figure this out? Why can't I be excited about this next thing that I'm going into? So understanding those things and helping them to see this is why this is happening before we get to what to do about it is kind of a good summary of how I start this work with clients who are experiencing transitions.
That's fantastic. And it's fantastic on so many levels, because like we were saying at the beginning, experiencing anxiety is a normal part of the human condition, right? And so I think within everything you've just said, that education is really important, because as you say, it kind of normalizes it. So it's no longer like, what's wrong with me? And it, all that, the sort of feeling of the racing thoughts and like, why is this happening? And then, you know, so often when we experience anxiety, we have an extra layer of anxiety about our anxiety. Mm-hmm. Whereas by having that education, it removes at least one of the layers. It removes that extra layer of, okay, I'm experiencing anxiety. This isn't like that there's something drastically wrong with me. It's a normal part of the human experience. It's because of these neurons are struggling to get, you know, from the amygdala to the prefrontal cortex, did you say? Biology was never my strong suit.
You got it.
And so I think that's great. And as you say, it helps therefore reduce shame around having anxiety. It helps, you know, and so much of anxiety as well comes from not knowing, right? Like, again, what you talked about, fear, the fear of the unknown can cause. So by having that knowledge, having that education, that's a fantastic first step. And that's, you know, I think in some ways you're introducing all the other interviews I'm doing and other people are doing and all the exercises and methodologies that we're providing throughout this conference, but you know, you're providing the why behind it. And I think that that's really important and really fantastic. So thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And so what would be the next step then?
Yeah, so everybody's process is different. So, and it's not linear, right? So sometimes we do the education and we start to learn some of the interventions and applying some of those things. Sometimes we're having to go back to some childhood experiences and some things that are learned. I mentioned earlier that sometimes our anxiety is very rooted in expectations of either that's been placed on us or that we're placing on ourselves. Sometimes we're hard on ourselves about things. Anxiety also can manifest sometimes as a lot of perfectionism, right? So I have to have everything correct the right way before I do anything. And if it's not happening that way, then again, some of those hard emotions or non-affirming thoughts and feelings are being kind of introduced into our psyche. What are some other things that come up? So sometimes going back again into those earlier kind of childhood or young adulthood experiences can surface some trauma, some traumatic events that have happened, some experiences that probably haven't been processed or understood in the most effective or healthy ways. And they're also having some root in some of these expectations or thoughts that are happening. And then we also have some people too that get stuck in like this analysis paralysis is what we call it, right? I'm thinking and overthinking everything so much. And because of the perfectionism, I'm so afraid to make a step or do something because I don't want to get it wrong. I don't want to disappoint people. I don't want to disappoint myself. And so we get stuck in doing anything. So the interventions and the processes from there really depends on what services for people and what becomes the root of some of the anxiety that is causing them to have some of the symptoms and the behaviors and the thoughts that they have, and really tailoring their next, you know, several sessions to identify and process some of those things. And we go back and forth, right? Sometimes we're educating on trauma and family of origin challenges or maladaptions to some of our cognitive processes. Sometimes we're doing a lot of CBT where we're training our brains to respond differently, to process differently. So there's a lot of different angles that can happen. And sometimes we're educating and then we're doing coping skills, but then we're going back to process and then we're doing it every which way from there too. But what we're really also doing from the clinical space is we're making sure that the symptoms that are most disruptive to clients' lives are actually decreasing, because that's the goal of therapy. When you have a mental health condition that's disrupting your natural life, we want to improve the quality of life and decrease those symptoms. So if there is a client that's coming to services rooted in anxiety, or we discover through conversation that anxiety is the root of what they're experiencing, then we want to make sure that we're tracking these symptoms and the experiences that they're having to make sure that over time, these things are being decreased.
And I love what you're saying about like how healing is nonlinear, right? Working with anxiety is nonlinear. So we'll have moments where we feel good, and anxiety particularly is one that can like pop up here and there. And like, we think everything's fine and then suddenly it pops up, or like a culmination of events make it come up. And then other times it can subside for a while. So I love what you were saying about that element of nonlinear, and as well what you were saying about, you know, so often we focus on anxiety as like a fear about the future, but that actually sometimes to work with it and heal from it, we need to go back into the past. We need to understand, you know, what traumas have happened, what is going on, what is triggering the anxiety. And I think it's great that what I hear from the work you do is there's a working with immediate symptoms as well as a sort of working on the history and sort of easing the sort of long-term causes and long-term anxiety, as well as working on sort of the immediate symptoms. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what some of those symptoms are and then go from there.
Yes. So some of the more common symptoms that we attach to anxiety, of course, is the fear and the worry, or fear-based thoughts and worry that can manifest in, again, ruminating thoughts where we just have continuous streams of thoughts that kind of, that are fear-based and rooted in worry that just continue. They're very hard to settle or to sometimes even source the different areas that they are coming from or that they pertain to. We have increased heart rate sometimes. And if we, that increased heart rate goes exponentially because those symptoms are very high, that can then increase or transition into panic attacks, which a lot of people experience those. We have sweating that can happen. Sometimes there's like a restless leg, or people are very fidgety sometimes when they're anxious. We also have upset stomach. So another of kind of those like psychological and biological connections is when I talked earlier about the neurons that are being developed or released when we are experiencing anxiety, and sometimes when there's an overproduction, those neurons actually communicate with our stomach lining. So you'll often notice that when people are very anxious, they may sometimes complain that they have a stomach ache or they feel queasy. And so the acid in our stomach is actually irritated sometimes when we have anxiety. And there's just this unsettling in our stomachs as well. Sometimes there's changes in appetite, there's changes in sleep. I often refer to anxiety as the culprit of the night, because when we have those anxious thoughts or those ruminating thoughts that go, 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 when we go throughout our days, oftentimes we're distracting ourselves, whether it's in work or through an exercise routine or hanging out with a friend. Sometimes we can avoid those thoughts and distract ourselves from those thoughts because we're engaged in other things. But when we lay down at night and try to rest ourselves, our brain is like, okay, I got all your attention now. And so things get louder sometimes in the nighttime. So we often see sleep disturbance as another symptom or consequence of experiencing anxiety too. So, wow, that was a lot of them. I think that's most. And of course, knowing that everybody doesn't experience all of those. Some people may never have a certain symptom while another person has a large kind of intensity or frequency of a particular symptom as well. One last one though, that I think sometimes gets misplaced. Sometimes we don't often name it as anxiety when it is that there's a lot of mood disturbance that can happen with anxiety as well. So being irritable or having lack of patience is huge symptoms of anxiety that sometimes people kind of miscalculate as mood disorders or other things, but that can also be anxiety. And lastly, anxiety disorders and depression disorders are actually the two largest co-occurring disorders that people experience, meaning that people can experience anxiety and experience depression at the same time. And so we'll often see a cycle of those symptoms. So the ruminating thoughts, the increased heart rate, the sweating, the disturbances in our belly sometimes, like sometimes that can have its effect when we experience that, but then it could kind of transition if we are experiencing that perfectionism or avoidance or things that are changing our behaviors. Sometimes again, that shame can come. We can feel bad about our lack of productivity or our lack of excitement of kind of what we're experiencing in our lives, or just if it's something hard that we're experiencing, that can have its own effects. And then it cycles right into depressive symptoms. And so then we become withdrawn. We sometimes isolate. Sometimes we feel sad. Sometimes there's anger associated to that. Sometimes we have extreme headaches or our appetite and our sleep gets disrupted as well. And because of those symptoms, anxiety can then get triggered again. So it can often be very overwhelming and unsettling when people are experiencing all of these things because it's hard to name it and source what is what and where things are coming from. And we often have an experience in our lives where it has to be a this or a that. And we don't often get encouraged to understand that as humans, we have duality in our experiences, right? So you can have this anxiety that's happening and also make space for being happy about what you are experiencing. Or you can have this anxious experience and also make space for understanding like, okay, sometimes this triggers depression for me and it's okay for me to name that. So in those symptoms, sometimes it can get very overwhelming and sometimes it can be unsettling, but being able to, again, I think just humanize the experience and be able to give ourselves space and grace for what's happening allows for clients to move through their therapeutic journey and their coping experience in a much more healthier way.
Mm. Thank you so much for that comprehensive explanation of like the symptoms and how they can impact the physiological and the mental, how so often anxiety can be combined with other things. Like you mentioned depression, but I know it can be combined with lots of other conditions, both sort of conditions that come under the mental health category, but also conditions that come under the physical health category, for example, and how anxiety is one of those conditions which, as you talked about, there's duality, right? So the duality with anxiety sometimes and positive feelings, but also anxiety is one of those conditions which feeds and gets fed and often creates these sort of cycles and vicious cycles. So you talked about the link with depression and how they sort of feed each other and they become this kind of, and it's so true, I think, in so many different ways. So again and again, the sort of normalizing it and the understanding it is so important. And so, and I'm the queen of like, trying to distract, when I get anxious, trying to distract myself. And then if I try and suddenly start to meditate, I've spoken about this with some meditation teachers, the sort of volume gets turned up of the anxiety, or trying to go to sleep. And so then it affects sleep. And then of course, when we're not sleeping properly, that impacts all kinds of other parts of our body and self. And then of course, that will then impact the anxiety. And again, that kind of, you know, not being able to sleep. So feeling anxious that we can't sleep. And then because we're anxious, we can't sleep even more. And so once again, it's that kind of, yeah, anxiety is a really difficult condition to live with, because as you say, it pops up in everyone. It pops up in so many different ways, and it feeds off of itself and other conditions. So it's a hard cycle to break.
Yeah.
And so, you know, amongst all the symptoms you've talked about, there is, of course, when anxiety reaches its peak, people can often experience panic attacks, for example. So maybe we could take some time to talk about what a panic attack is and how to manage that.
Yes. So one, let me say, I love how you summarize and paraphrase. It just makes for a really great conversation. But yes, sometimes the symptoms just get very escalated. They come very strong. They're very intense. There really isn't a true source as to where a panic attack comes from outside of just the intensity of symptoms that we've kind of already spoken about regarding anxiety. But it's when those symptoms that are experienced, especially the increased heart rate, sometimes there's hyperventilation, so our breathing gets disrupted and very labored. When there's those ruminating thoughts that are happening and that fear is on 200, right? So those main symptoms get very, very elevated and escalated. And that transitions into our brains sometimes going into a defense, because it's being communicated to in a sense that's saying, we are not okay. We're not safe right now. We're in the utmost of danger, and our body is trying to make sense of it. It can be very scary for a person that's experiencing a panic attack, though, because those symptoms of increased heart rate, not being able to breathe, having really increased fear, those are all the same symptoms of heart attacks as well. So when people experience panic attacks, it can often be very challenging to help them to kind of regain kind of their composure and to breathe, because it feels as if my body is going through an experience that is harmful, right? But it's important for people who have anxiety, again, that kind of psychoeducation things, to know that these are normal symptoms that can happen. And something that can help us differentiate is that panic attacks typically reduce in their intensity within 10 minutes. Right? So helping a client to understand and know that we just got to get through minute, right? And 10 minutes can feel like a very long time when we're having a panic attack, but teaching them how to be mindful in their bodily experience, which is why yoga and mindfulness and guided visualizations and deep breathing is so important, because it helps us to be self-aware in our own individual experience in our body, right? So having that level of awareness to say, okay, this is a panic attack, I know what's happening, that allows us to gain some kind of control to say, okay, I just need to deep breathe right now. I need to practice some thought stopping. And with thought stopping, that allows for whatever those fear-based thoughts that are taking the focus in our brains, we're able to pause. We can't stop them immediately, even though the name of the exercise is called thought stopping. We can't stop them immediately, but we can force a pause. We can force a space that allows our brains to be distracted by something else. So often people think of a happy place or something, a safe space for them. They think of a calming thought, a happy memory, a person sometimes that might be very grounding and safe for them. But you want to introduce something into your brain that allows your brain to get distracted. Our brains are the most sophisticated organ in our body, but they're also very distractible. And that distracting kind of capability is very, very helpful when someone is having a panic attack, because it slowly pulls our brain into a different space. And that distraction allows for that time that's needed for us to regulate our breathing, for us to practice that emotion regulation, for us to settle our heart rate, to get that circadian rhythm back in its normal rhythm. And it allows for a person to navigate that panic attack, not necessarily feeling safe immediately, but they transition into feeling safe by realizing what they're going through and saying, okay, I know this is a panic attack. I need to activate my deep breathing. I need to activate my mindfulness. Let me bring that safe space or that happy place into my brain and let me wait this out. And again, sounds very easy to talk through. And anyone who has experienced a panic attack knows how unsettling and hard that feels. I'm a therapist who experiences anxiety, so I get it. But learning, and this is also why preventative measures and reactive measures are important. So when we talk about coping skills of deep breathing, mindfulness, grounding, those are all things that we can do in the moment that can help us to regulate our emotions and to navigate those experiences healthily. But it's equally as important when we are not having elevated symptoms, when we are actually calm and we're probably not experiencing a great deal of anxiety. It's important for us to practice those preventative measures so that our brain and our minds can start to learn these interventions so that it can become second nature, right? So when we think about creating new neural pathways in our brain, we have to teach it the different route to go. And just thinking about school or any other place where you learn something, it's a lot better to learn it calm than to learn it elevated or just not in a good space. So practicing yoga, walking, exercising, any other kind of meditative practices, really like paying attention to regulating chakras, whatever that thing might be for you, aromatherapy, massages, acupuncture, chiropractics, like whatever that might be that allows for that stress and that tension to be released from the body. Progressive muscle relaxation is also a really great one too, where we intentionally pull tension into certain places of our body, but then we mindfully release those. So we might intentionally tense up our shoulders or clench our jaws or squeeze our hands, but then we mindfully experience our bodies releasing as we deep breathe too. So in the moment for a panic attack, or when someone is experiencing a panic attack, all those things are super helpful. Then it's also equally as important in those times when we're not having a panic attack or our anxiety is not as elevated as other times to practice some of those techniques as well, because our brain is learning that when that time comes, now we know what to go to and what to do. And it helps that 10 minutes or so go by a little bit easier.
Absolutely. And I love what you're saying about the importance of preventative and reactive measures, right? And practices. And I think we offer a whole range of them on this conference. We talk about why each one can help. We also offer free meditation and yoga or mindful movement or Qigong sessions each day that people can join in. And again, I think that one of the key things that I took from that is that how, you know, these practices, as well as helping sort of regulate our nervous system and rewire the neural pathways and ease during a panic attack, for example, and sort of help with the chronic anxiety in the long term, it also helps cultivate that self-awareness that you were talking about, so that when these moments happen, when we experience anxiety, we're less identified with the anxiety itself. We're not just living the anxiety, we're living it. And there's the voice in our head that's like, oh, okay, I know what this is. And so even though we are still maybe experiencing all the physiological symptoms that you were talking about, there's still, like, it's almost like having someone with us during the panic attack, right? It's that, and I know I've experienced that myself. I've done a lot of sort of personal development work. My meditation teacher is a father who's been like, so I've been doing it since I was a child. And I am a very anxious person who has experienced panic attacks. So it's, again, you know, it's like in those moments, of course, those things help, but they help more, as you say, almost not in those moments of crisis, but it's supporting ourselves in the long run so that when those moments of crisis come up, we have like a tool belt and a bunch of skills and tools that we can use in those moments, which is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of like sports too, with muscle memory. Like the more that you practice, the more that your body learns how to run that race or throw that ball or swim those laps, it becomes muscle memory, and you're really teaching your brain and your body how to work together and do it almost automatically. And that's the same thing that we're doing in this particular way as well.
Mm. And it was really interesting as well what you were saying about sort of distractibility, right? Because we talked about it as sort of a symptom. So sometimes we're getting distracted and then we go to bed at night and the, you know, it's more into the anxiety and the thoughts are more intense. So sometimes it sort of prohibits us, but it's an alarm bell when we notice. I speak about this with Dr. Sophia Graham as well on this conference. But like when we talk about when we're watching more TV or playing games on our phone more regularly, often that's an alarm, because whether we're conscious of it or not, we're distracting ourselves from our thoughts. And once again, with practices like meditation and mindfulness and yoga and all these kind of things, that helps us notice what's happening and then take a step back. But I love what you were saying about how, yes, it's a symptom, but it's also supportive during those moments of crisis, during those panic attacks, for example, to use. And that's also why we distract ourselves, right? So often it's our brain, like you said, is very intelligent, but also, yeah. And so again, that kind of, like you say, so doing deep breathing, thinking of happy thoughts, whether it's thinking of someone comforting, to bring about that kind of neurological response to imagining someone safe and comforting, whether it's imagining a beautiful place. Sometimes things that help me is sort of like looking around the room and naming or pointing objects. So it's like focusing on something else. For me personally, I like, you know, focusing on external things helps ground me, which is also why I like playing games on my phone at times, because but then again, the internal practices as well, it's of as you say, sort of deep breathing and imaginings and things like that. So I think that's so important to bring in.
Essentially, when we think about anxiety, you know, it's so complicated, but then it's so simple too, because it's really rooted in our brains believing that we're safe and okay, right? So all these different things that we talked about in regards to tools or coping measures or supportive resources and resourcing that we can do within our body, it's essentially for our brain and our body to be one and connected and say, yep, we're okay. We're good. We're fine. There's no immediate danger. We are safe. And if we can remember that and focus on that and identify and determine what things do that for us, it allows for this very sometimes complicated and distressing experience to become a lot more individualized and impactful and effective for us too.
Absolutely. Well, Melissa, I'm aware of time, but I'm hoping that this conversation has helped people A, normalize anxiety, understand a bit where it comes from, what's happening in the brain, why it shows up, how it shows up, some of the symptoms and some coping skills. And excited to find out more about this conference, because we have lots more fantastic speakers offering different skills and exercises, talking more about how it comes about and how to manage it. How can we find out more about you and your work?
Absolutely. So you can visit our website for my practice, which is golddrivencounseling.com. And I'd be happy to engage with anyone that comes to this conference. And just thank you all so much for this amazing resource to our community.
Thank you. And I think you also do a lot of virtual work, right? So people can come and work with you from wherever they're based.
Yes. So of course, with therapy, we still have licensing regulations that kind of prohibit. But outside of my clinical practice, I work with other mental health therapists that are looking to integrate just virtual services, telemental health, grow virtual practices as well. So that's also something in some of the work that I do. that is super helpful. And it was super just timely to be positioned in this way. My practice has been virtual for 5 years. So we were very in this space before the pandemic, and it's been awesome to be able to support other clinicians that have had to make that transition. And now they're trying to figure out, do I go back? Do I stay? And what works for me and my clientele. So I love doing that side of my work too.
Fantastic. I love that because it makes this work suddenly so much more accessible, which is also why we do these online conferences. Thank you so much for your time today, Melissa. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.